You're listening to Disturbing the Priest with Brandon Baddock.
It's awesome having you on the show. I'd love to know, what made you want to pursue journalism?
Wow, that's kind of interesting, because I really almost didn't. It took a long time. I mean, I did an independently produced book of record reviews, 1942 record reviews, called Riff Kills Man, 25 Years of Recorded Hard Rock and Heavy Metal. That was 1993, so I was already 30. So I just did that book. And then because I was in Toronto by that time, I happened to, make the acquaintance of Tim Henderson, who was running, the flagship heavy metal collection at the flagship HMV on the flagship intersection of Canada, like literally the main intersection, right? Young and Dundas. And he was breaking away from Meat Magazine. Meat Magazine was, Yeah, I think they were kind of ending business at that point. Drew Masters, he's a good buddy of ours too. But Tim started a magazine, and we met at the store, and I started writing for him. And, he quickly grew the magazine, and I became editor in chief while he was still the boss. And just interviewing tons of rock stars, writing reviews, getting sent free CDs, all that fun stuff. And so that got the ball rolling. So literally, 30 to 40 years old was kind of my start.
Wow.
Well, 30, let's say 30 to 36 years old was the start. Yeah.
Very cool. I kind of like, in terms of like journalism, I never really wanted to be a journalist. But this podcast has kind of turned me into one.
Yeah.
Because I used to just have comedians on to talk music. Right. And then I'm like, well, comedians suck at scheduling. So I've had enough bands on at this point where I'm like, all right, I guess I'm doing this. Very interesting to hear. Now, I know you have so many books. You have so many opinions on music. I have that moment where I remember sitting and listening to the radio and hearing that song like War Pigs for the first time. Mm-hmm. And in a way, almost like gaining consciousness. Like, whoa, like this is music. Do you have a moment like that for you where you like realize like music is something you're very, very into?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, come to think of it. So I started with my earliest memories are like the Columbia Record Club, where you send away and you get hooked into that hole. They'll send you stuff and you got to send it back if you don't want it, kind of thing. And I remember getting a couple albums. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And I remember getting like a Three Dog Night Live album, Steppenwolf Gold. That's important because, okay. And also a couple Creedence Clearwater albums. Right. And I knew immediately that anything that was kind of heavier extreme on them was my favorite stuff. Right. And so that led me into heavier stuff. But, to answer your question, almost like that molten guitar noise at the beginning of Magic Carpet Ride on Steppenwolf Gold, right? Was super inflaming, right? And as was when the song kicks in, even though it's not heavy, but when it kicks in, it's just one of the hookiest kind of like chord patterns, Magic Carpet Ride, right? Not Born to Be Wild, but Magic Carpet Ride,
yeah.
Right? And so, as a 6 or 7 year old kid, you're into the hookiness of this rock and roll thing. And then one thing I didn't realize until years later, when we were doing like the Metal Evolution episodes, and we were pontificating about the extremity of various parts of heavy music, and one of those things is vocals, right? And then I thought back to as a kid, that's why I liked Steppenwolf. And that's even why I liked Creedence Clearwater Revival, because John Fogerty had an extreme voice, right? It was shouty and kind of like sounded like a panther, and same with John Cave from Steppenwolf, right? And when we did those episodes, we talked about, where did that start? Is it Little Richard? Is it Paul McCartney and John Lennon yelling, right? So that's kind of the funny thing. And then after that, I think my first memory of heaviness is probably Led Zeppelin Rock and Roll or Led Zeppelin Black Dog. That was a really early heavy album that I remember hearing, and just hearing the hi-hat open and the Robert Plant wailing and just the noise and the distortion of the production. and it's just like a wall of sound, a wall of mid-range sound. I seem to remember that as being like, wow, this is like super energetic, exciting music. And that was the first heavy music.
Very, very cool to hear. I'm just curious, what can you tell me about the band Torque?
Oh yeah. So that was just our you know, we were a professional band, when meaning we got paid by bars. You know, we didn't play a lot of gigs, but it was just one of those come home from university, you know, bands put together by a bunch of buddies, and we had no originals. It was just covers, right? And we just played the local bars around Trail and Castlegard, Roslyn, maybe Creston, all over BC sort of thing. And yeah, our banner was in the Iron Maiden letters, right, and all that, and I was the drummer, and we had two guitars and a bass player, and yeah, just played you know, some popular covers and a lot of obscure covers.
When's the last time you did a show with them?
Oh, that would have been like 1984.
Wow,
ages ago. Yeah. And then I played with a few other little, you know, band situations here and there. I remember I was the drummer for a punk rock battle of the bands for a band in Hamilton years and years later. But the drums basically go into storage and I haven't been playing them because Toronto's very expensive for real estate. Right. And, you know, our house is not a detached house. It's a semi, right? Or townhouse, the way you call them, I guess, but more like a semi. It's a Toronto thing, right? But but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I even think nowadays, if we had a detached house in a neighborhood, because I remember even around Toronto hearing drummers playing houses, and I think, you know, you're being jerky even playing drums in a house, period, right? Because you can hear it outside pretty clearly, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of funny, but yeah, I think those days are over.
Well, very interesting to learn about. Something else that was interesting that I learned about you is your history as a painter. I really had no idea how passionate you were. What is your whole timeline with painting?
Well, I just really haven't done very much. I really am dying to get back to it. I've got all kinds of, you know, I'm stretching my own canvases, still got a lot of that, doing a lot of drawing. So I've been doing some illustrations for this kind of long story, Blue Oyster Cult related Imaginos book thing that I've done one, and I'm trying to get the second one done. So, and then I've just been drawing rock stars and just doing stuff where you're not making a lot of a mess, and it's pretty convenient art making. But the painting stuff was all kind of like mid late 90s, and sold a lot of them and was in a couple of galleries and stuff, and then just kind of it just dropped off. I just stopped doing it, and I just want to get back to it.
Yeah, you seem like you're doing a lot. Like, you got the books, you got the Sea of Tranquility stuff, painting, very busy, pretty awesome. You know, nothing wrong with that, I feel.
Yeah, just the video and the podcast stuff just takes over a lot of your time, right? So we've got our Contrarians video channel, which constantly flooding with content. And then I'm on Pete's show, Sea of Tranquility, once a week. And then I've got my History in Five Songs with Martin Popoff audio podcast, which is every week like clockwork. I'm up to 225 episodes of that now. So
Very exciting.
That stuff takes a lot of time, and you know, it's somewhere between no pay and just pennies kind of thing. but it's fun to do, right? And it's you know, and you love reading the comments and stuff, and so yeah, it's a neat pastime. And then you think, you know, you think, oh, it must help with book sales or whatever, and you rationalize it that way too. So
yeah, I have the same thing where it's like, I do this and it's really like the biggest pain. But it's like, hey, you know, might get me booked. So
yeah. I love your setup. It's so professional, right? It's so cool looking.
I appreciate it, man. I went to school for radio, but unfortunately we live in a different time. So I kind of just took it, you know, to my own thing. And it's way better. You know, I could talk to all these metal artists. I can kind of do whatever I want. Weekly episodes. It's like, it's pretty awesome gig.
Oh,
way
yeah.
Better.
You could grow it and get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? If you just keep at it. So
that's what's awesome about the internet, man. You can just really just do your own thing. You can carve your own path. Like, I used to work in a Republican talk radio, and I was like, what am I doing here? You know, I want to talk to bands and stuff. So you have a famously a lot of music opinions, and this is a metal show we're on here. I would love to hear your thoughts on who invented heavy metal.
Boy, that's a long one. I've actually got an entire book called
Who
Invented Heavy Metal, right? It's 120,000 words, so it's a pretty long book, and it ends in 1971, right? So it's, imagine all of that going into it. But, you know, the short answer, you know, it's funny. If I got asked that question, I was told, here's 10 different lengths of answers you can give. I could probably fill all of them, right? But to give a somewhat short answer, I would say the original building blocks that are at least a minute or two or five long would be Cream and Jimi Hendrix, more so Jimi Hendrix. And then as you intensify up the ladder a little bit, Blue Cheer, MC5, Iggy and the Stooges, The Stooges, not Iggy and the Stooges. But then the most important or the correct answer, as I like to say, is Black Sabbath, with Black Sabbath 1, February 10th, 1970, right?
Yeah.
February 10th. Friday the 13th. February the 13th, yeah. 1970. and then the way that book ends, because I cheated to get it into 1971. And the reason I do that is because I like to show that Black Sabbath was much more intentional with it than Deep Purple or Uriah Heep, although Uriah Heep by the end of 71, actually, well, you know, they had Salisbury in there, so they weren't as intentional. And Deep Purple wasn't as intentional because you had Fireball in there, right? So the other part of the answer that I like to say is, like, because I like to argue that, you know, to say somebody invented heavy metal, you got to make an album of it, right? So the other thing I like to sort of say is that in 1970, you got four albums that invented heavy metal proper, like for real, for serious. You got two Black Sabbath albums, one Uriah Heep album, and Deep Purple in Rock. So you got Uriah Heep, Very Heavy, Very Humble, Black Sabbath, later in the year, Black Sabbath, Paranoid, and Deep Purple in Rock. So those four together, because soon as you say all this, everybody says, oh, what about the Blue Cheer album, man, and stuff like that, right? But to me, it's those four.
Totally, man. I 100% respect that and agree. And it is crazy because you have bands like Coven that almost got there. They had the lyrical content, but they never really hit that heaviness. It was so interesting. I was listening to that record recently where it literally has a song called Black Sabbath. Very interesting. Yeah. I think they're on tour right now, which is insane.
Is that the band that has a John Osborne in the band too?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
Now I think what just came out is the Rolling Stones best guitarist list. Do you have an opinion on those lists? I know a lot of them come out. It's always Hendrix at number one. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I make a ton of lists all the time too, so I can't put down lists in general. But a lot of people have been attacking that list in particular because, you know, there's always a whole pile of politics and age and you know, what is the market of the magazine and stuff that goes into it. So there's a lot of politically correct people on that list, probably who shouldn't be on that list. But then also you think, can you really compare, you know, guitarists and say who is the greatest or whatever, because, you know, people do different things, right? It's an art form, right? It's invisible sound waves and stuff like that, right? But if they put Hendrix number one, I could agree with that, because part of being considered a best on along, and we always have this debate about Jimmy Page and Neil Peart and all this kind of stuff, right? Part of being the best is A, best for your time, best for your day. So, and everybody, like in sports, everybody break, you know, people break sports records or set sports records, and then they get broken and they get broken again and broken again. So the fact of the matter is, literally, those people running that dash or having, you know, that many yards in a season or whatever, are the best literally until that record's broken again. Right. And they're somewhat better than the people before, cause they broke the record. Right. So, in his day, I mean, I think literally there's like, I've often sort of said that, you know, if you really wanted to be brutal about it and say how many Guitar Heroes were there ever, right? I'd say two. I'd say it's Jimi Hendrix and Eddie Van Halen. And yeah. And other than that, it's like, you know, really cool guitar players, but they're also songwriters, but they aren't as distinct as Jimmy and Eddie. And you don't really focus on the guitar nearly as much, or they have other reasons not to consider them Guitar Heroes or whatever. So, you know, because there's only two guys like that. And then Jimi Hendrix was just so, you know, he just brought so many new things all at once. He just scared everybody. Right.
Yeah.
That's a good choice for number one.
Yeah. Very, very cool angle. One of my favorite guitarists is Tony Iommi, the Riffmaster. I know you have a book on the 80s and 90s of that era of Sabbath. What made you want to write about that particular era of Sabbath?
Well, it's actually a two-part book. So I do have an early one and a later one. And I've done
Sabotage,
that
right?
I've done that for like 5 or 6 or 10 bands, it seems like, where I've busted it into two books and stuff. So I did that. And the reason I stopped at a certain part is that really it got so messy after. And it's a kind of a bit of a long story, but Heaven and Hell, a lot of that is in a different Sabbath book I did, the Black Sabbath FAQ. And then after that, there's only Black Sabbath 13, blah, 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 reunion shows. It's all, you know, so I just found a tidy place to end it, right? And it was the end of the decade and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I would put him super high as well. But again, you know, you think of him as a great writer of riffs, and then you don't really think of him so much when it comes to the guitar soloing or whatever, right? Yeah. And he's part of this absolutely amazing band. So he's not the focus of the whole thing like a Jimi Hendrix would be on that list.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I think the album Born Again is very interesting and definitely stands out in the band's discography. I'd love to know, what are some of your thoughts on this record?
Yeah, I've always liked it. I mean, everybody talks about that production on it. And of course, the production is very hard to get into. But, you know, once you're immersed in it and playing it, you're okay with it. I don't think it was a good fit with Ian Gillan as a lyricist. He's being his usual kind of goofy wordsmith lyricist on it. And it kind of undercuts the vibe of the thing. And the album cover is really stupid too. But and I like most of the second side songs better than the first side songs. Like I like Digital Bitch and Hot Wire. What was it called? So
I know what you mean.
Even as a dark one, take me on the hot one, something like that. Hotline.
Yeah.
I like Trash and I like Disturbing the Priest and Zero the Hero and all that stuff as well. But so I think it's a good solid album. But and you know, and they think about doing a just a remaster of it.
Remaster.
What would be amazing is get in there with the guts and do an actual remix, like a really cool, you know, fixing up that way and don't change any of the performances. That I would love to hear. That would be cool.
I would love to do that. I know that's supposed to happen after all these Tony Martin albums get reissued. Finally,
right.
You know, it's the only way to really listen to them is on YouTube, which sucks. I just love that album. Weirdly enough, I even like the production has really grown on me because you put it on and it's easily the eeriest Sabbath album, in my opinion, because you put it on and the production almost sounds like unworldly. Like it's a very scary sound. And then you have even like on the song Disturbing the Priest, you have those vocals come in and it's like, what the hell is this? So I do like that. I really want to see what it will sound like once it gets remastered. But, you know, I feel like there is something special with that really shitty, muddy mix with that album. It's almost like very black metal-esque, which is really cool. But we'll probably see it on vinyl soon enough with a clean thing. I know vinyl has had a comeback as of late, outsold CDs within the last 3 years. What's your opinion on vinyl and general physical media in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy very much anymore, and I really don't care about old records being reissued on vinyl. I would never buy vinyl of new albums either. But because to me, I'm like kind of a big book collector guy too. So I like the idea of the first edition. So I think the one with the most emotional attachment is always like the music being released on the format that God intended, sort of thing, right? So, you know, Pantera on vinyl means nothing to me. It's their CD band, right? And same with all my 70s bands. You know, the original vinyl is what matters the most, and even there, to me, what has the most magic to it is the vinyl from the country that the band is from, right? That to me even feels more like the first edition, right? Even though technically it might not be, right? So yeah, I mean, it's cool that it's back, and it's gaining a little in popularity. I mean, I think most people, it's kind of neat that it's more almost like a paper good. It's almost like a collectible, because most people are really not going to be listening to it on vinyl as much. They just kind of want to own it to look at it or whatever, or show on their YouTube show or whatever, right? But yeah, it's cool. It's cool that it's happening, and you get a lot of colored vinyl and stuff like that too. But I don't know. I'm just I've been won over by the whole streaming thing, right? I mean, it's basically the way I listen to all my music anyways. So
it really has changed the entire music industry. And I do find streaming to be very important, actually. Because before, you know, if you wanted to get your music out there, it had to be like at a record store. It was very regional. Now it's like you just press a button and it's global. And now it's like recently I had this band from this thrash metal band from Pakistan on. And the only reason why they're able to even have a fan base is because of streaming. How important do you find streaming to be in overall like music as an art form?
Yeah, it's great because, I mean, the big thing is we've just got all this music for essentially our monthly subscription fee, right? And yeah, we could just look up anything we want. And so when I play something now, it's a two-part process. Or when I'm learning about a band or want to hear the details or stuff, it's open the wiki page and it's open the stream and Spotify, right? And, because Spotify, if you don't know what you're looking for, if you're not looking, you know, if you want to find a specific album or whatever, it's annoying that Spotify, you know, puts newest to oldest, right? So you've got all the live albums and compilations of some old band before you get to the actual album. So you got to look it up on Wiki first or whatever. So, but no, it's great. And you get all the bonus tracks and and it almost makes, you know, the whole thing, you know how it was important to have journalists in the old days, right? In the old days, it was almost like it was important to have journalists to tell you about stuff. Well, it that's kind of the same thing now, but now it's more like you need the sources of journalism just to be gatekeepers and to take that massive fire hose of music and tell you, like, you know, if you like this kind of music, go try this band or this band or this band, because there's just so much out there, right? So yeah, the reason to have journalists and stuff is still totally important. I mean, if I'm looking for something and just kind of wanting to explore a genre or whatever, my first thing to look up is let's go look up some top 10 lists, right? And go through the names of the bands. Okay, put them into Spotify, check them out, right? Read what they say about them, because yeah, without that, you'd be totally lost. So
very cool. For example, a lot of the bands I have on are like 80s thrash metal bands that kind of died when the 90s came around. And it is a very intimidating thing because you do have a billion bands on this thing. It's where do I even start? And going back to that, I am trying to like have some bands on the show, some thrash bands, you know, talk about their history, learn more about them. I find thrash metal to be a very interesting genre or subgenre, I should say, of heavy metal. Do you have an opinion on like what really killed thrash metal? Once 1990 really came around, I feel like 80% of those bands kind of stopped. There's all those, there's so many bands that have those two records that's like 85, 87, and then that's it. Do you think there's a defining thing?
Interesting. I've never really thought about this, but I mean, it must be said that most of the bigger thrash bands did continue on and semi-thrived or completely thrived. But you're right, a bunch went away. And if you did go away, it was probably just because you were caught in the big net of the backlash against heavy metal in general, led by hair metal, right? So, you know, I guess you were caught in that hair metal net. You were caught in the hair net, you know, if you were just a band that wasn't big enough yet, right? When grunge took over. So when grunge took over, it was the new kind of heavy metal. And I still maintain grunge is a totally a heavy metal genre. I've always thought that.
Interesting.
So I guess some of those bands just went away because there was just so much ridicule of hair metal, which, you know, went on and spread to metal in general. And, you know, we all know, because we were running a magazine, you know, getting it off the ground in 94, 95, 96, 97, the topic of conversation in all our interviews we would do with everybody was just complain about how everybody was putting down heavy metal all the time, right? So heavy metal was totally not in vogue. But having said that, you know, all of the big four and all those bands were all making lots of music all through the 90s and 2000s, right?
Totally. Megadeth had an amazing career in the 90s. The big four, even Testament, Exodus was fine. In my opinion, I think it is like, I definitely agree with what you're saying. I also think it is the Black Album, and that really, I feel like Metallica were kind of the flag carriers of that genre. And then once they put out the Black Album, it's like, all right, it's over. We're doing our own thing. Even Megadeth put out Risk. Slayer even experimented with some like new metal-ish stuff. So it definitely was, there were many, many aspects to its fall. Now, I know you've met a lot of musicians. Lemmy, for example, pretty funny picture. Who are some of your favorite musicians you've met in person?
Boy, like the ones that I had the best time with and hung out with and got along with and had a good time, I would say Zakk Wylde definitely would have to be up there. Joelyn Turner is always a super interesting guy to talk to. He's just an interesting guy, right? A lot of topics, fast talker, you know, talks a lot. So he's a super nice guy to hang out with. Bill Ward is great, but in person only once. Yeah, maybe just the one time in person with Bill Ward, but on the phone, he's always great. Just such a great interview all the time. Who else? Lemmy's kind of a funny one, because Lemmy always is the guy that says, you know, he would say, yeah, let's meet afterward. We'll have a beer, right? And you don't think he really ever means it, right? It just sounds like a line that he says, but I don't think he really wants to hang out with people. But I've met him many times, and it was cool. He does kind of give your attention when you're with him, right? But everybody kind of wants his attention. Ronnie James Dio is super nice too to hang out with, right? He was fine as well. So, definitely a lot over the years, right?
Yeah, and throughout these years, were a lot of those meets tame? Did it ever get to the point where I'm like, wow, this, we're really, you know, partying?
No. You know, I mean, drank a few beers with Zakk, definitely, in his drinking days. But no, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, even back then, I was a real wimp when it came to staying up super late, right? I mean, the joke with all of us as journalists is you'd go to the show reluctantly. I mean, number one, you'd do the interview sometime in the afternoon, right? And then it's like, oh, now I got to go back, right? So you go back to the show or whatever. And then, you know, the joke is always like, you're there and like three or four songs in, you're just like looking for the exits. Like, how do I get out of here with nobody noticing I'm leaving, right? Sort of thing, right? So there's not a lot of, and then after the show, there was never really much partying after the show, if you even managed to stay that long, because A, the show's got to end. B, they need their time to, you know, decompress and shower and all that stuff. So you're hanging around in the venue. That's one of the worst things when there's a meet and greet after the show, right? You're just standing around. Everybody's tired. It's 12:30 at night, right? So, it's definitely there's never been all that much partying. The funnest stuff I you know, think from memory, always the funnest was when you'd go onto the bus and you'd drink some beers with them on the bus before the show. And that could be anywhere from 4 PM or 2 PM with Zach, or up to, you know, I think the party kind of starts to get going around 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, right? You know, and the guys will have a couple beers, even though they still got to go on, they got a headline or whatever. Right. So that's a nice time, eh? That's a nice time when you could feel the excitement level picking up. Right. And you're on the bus with them but that means you're not seeing the band that you interviewed earlier, and you're feeling guilty about that because they're on right now. And yet you're on the bus with these guys, and it's like, everything gets all confused. And so, funny. I've never really talked about any of this before.
Cool. We're breaking new ground. Awesome. Yeah. Now I know, you've talked about the past so much, like, 70s, 80s, 90s, even just like a general timeline of music. Where do you see music going? What do you think the evolution of the art form is headed?
God, I don't know. I mean, I think we'll just keep getting lots of everything. I mean, take heavy metal, you know, specifically, it's getting so extreme and proggy at the same time. And you look at what's happening in vocals, right? I mean, metal, you know, it's hard to imagine. I wouldn't, if you would have asked me 15, 20 years ago, could metal get more extreme? I'd say, I would have said no, right? Because we've been through Pantera, we've been through death, we've been through black metal, we've seen the extremity in all the different departments, vocals, every instrument, production, you know, anti-commercialness with drone or black metal for that matter, right?
Sun, also
speed, yeah exactly. So metal's gotten more extreme, right? So it would not be smart of us to say it can't even get more extreme, although it's hard to imagine how, right? I mean, like I say, it's Stephen Wilson told me this once years and years ago, and I thought it was pretty interesting. He said, heavy metal is the new progressive rock, right? And you see that all every year, right? So when you see these extreme, what do they call them? What's the new? It's not deathcore, but it's there's a new term for the super extreme progressive metal right now. That sounds like deathcore. It's got core in it somehow. Anyway,
metalcore?
Nah,
is that what it's called?
Metalcore is even an old term. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is no new term, but I think there is. But
might be deathcore, right? Isn't that a kind of?
Yeah, it could be deathcore. Yeah,
2000s.
But I'm talking the stuff you're hearing right now, like the super extreme stuff you're hearing right now with the real vomited, you know, pig squeal vocals, right? Like the extreme death metal now is so progressive. I mean, the playing on it is off the chart, right? And it all insane. Started with a little bit of this Gent and Meshuggah 20 years ago, but it's, so you're hearing that influence still in it, but you're hearing just an amazing amount of progressiveness, right? So I think every single genre is going to have like people populating it and doing stuff. And, but yeah, it's so democratic. The whole label system's gone away. So like you were saying earlier, it's literally
good riddance.
And to get their stuff out there and get their views, however they can get their plays or views, right? And the concert industry seems to be in good shape. So that's the other thing. So, you know, it's the music industry didn't just get decimated and crashed the way people thought it might. But, you know, it technically, I guess, has crashed for any individual band because there's an exponential amount of bands all the time vying for your attention. Right. So, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that, literally since the music industry began, there's it's almost like the pie is still expanding, But the sliver, the piece of that pie that you get, is getting smaller and smaller all the time.
That's a great way to put it. I 100% agree. And what you were saying about labels, good riddance, in my opinion. Labels pretty much destroyed most of the new wave of British heavy metal bands. Even the band Jaguar, you know, totally ruined them. They only had like 4 days to record Power Games. The only person they had in a studio to help them was like the coffee intern. Neat and all that was the worst. I think this new era of home studios is amazing. And I really hope we get to the point where labels just really distribute instead of, you know, this, the whole stupid thing where they really take over a band completely. Do you find labels to have really had a very big negative effect on the new wave of British heavy metal bands?
But what does distribute even mean anymore? It's like, if you're a band, you put your stuff on Spotify or you put your stuff on YouTube, you've taken care of pretty much an Apple Music, right? Yourself, you've taken care of 80% of all the meaningful, relevant, proper, smart distribution that you ever needed to do, right? I mean, and at that point, you got to promote it. You got to figure out a way to have people, you know, listen to you, right? But that's your distribution right there. It's like, took you an afternoon probably, right? To like distribute better than any label could ever have distributed you in the past, right?
And it's crazy because like TikTok now, like bands are using that as their marketing. They don't have to worry about billboards or plastering a thing. It's about like, you know, not only putting out your music, but learning like an algorithm.
Yeah.
Which I find pretty interesting. And I think it's kind of unfortunate because not a lot of musicians are, you know, social media marketers. And it is like a new thing that plays in bands.
Yeah.
I feel, unless you just get signed to that label and they're like, all right, we'll take care of everything. I see now to bring it back to what we were saying before, the evolution of like music, I should say, I want to point out a band, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. I'm not sure if you've heard of them. Their second record is like an outlaw country album, and their 17th album is a just straight up thrash metal record. So I think that's kind of the direction things are going to go in, because I'm only 25 and I grew up with everything. You know, I grew up with old school hip hop, with like Kraftwerk, you know, with outlaw country, Marty Robbins. My dad got me into like Dio and all that older stuff. So it's like, I think this is what we're going to see now, where bands, genres are kind of might become like a thing of a past, where it's like just bands are just everything. Do you see that happening more?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. That could happen, because I remember seeing on TikTok, did you ever see that TikTok video of that that band like oscillating back and forth between jazz and thrash?
Yes.
Like literally they look like they're standing in a bar, right?
Yeah.
And they're playing this cocktail jazz, and then it turns into a thrash song, and then it goes back to jazz and stuff.
Insane.
So, I mean, I can't see every band, you know, that being something that every band wants to do. And logically speaking, there's no real reason for it other than being a genre in itself, which it probably will be, and it would probably be totally populated. And King Gizzard, or, you know, I've yet to listen to them. I've heard of them many times, right? Because that's another long story. Just like what. I don't have a big point or a big reason to be playing these bands if I'm not going to write about them or whatever. And because I don't have a place to record, put down, to remind myself to go back and re-listen or whatever. That's another long story. But I think logically speaking, there's no reason every band should want to do that, because, you know, there's fans of genres that aren't going to be fans of another genre, right? So why would you want your band to do a bunch of different genres, right? So, but yeah, it's an interesting thing that'll probably literally become like a genre in itself.
Yeah, well said. And that band, it's a whole can of worms. They started in like 2011. This month, they're putting out their 25th album. They have jam. They have rap. It's just insane. It's a mess. Well, this has been an awesome conversation, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
No worries.
What's the best way for people to just like stay updated with all your work?
Well, martinpopoff.com has every book that I have, and I'm a mail order guy of everything that I've put out. So I sign them and send them out from my office here in Toronto, and there's full descriptions there and PayPal buttons. So that's the best place to see all the books in one big long row. Other than that, the Facebook page, or keep an eye on our Contrarians channel, or listen to my podcast, History in Five Songs. And yeah, everything you'll, you know, eventually, if you listen to too much of all my stuff, you'll probably hear me repeat stories over and over again, because I've said them on so many different shows and stuff, right? You know, Pete and I are always pulling our hair, figuring out, have we done a show on that yet? And we look it up and we're trying to search. I feel like we've done this exact show before, right? And, you know, we have to like literally look, and then he's done a million shows and I've done a million shows. So that happens a lot. But yeah, so martinpopoff.com, but I'm pretty good with the Facebook too, not too many other things, but yeah, those are the main places.
Awesome. martinpopoff.com, down in this description below. Definitely you can go more in depth of some of the topics we talked about today. Really appreciate you coming on the show, man. I'm Brandon Baddock, and this is Disturbing the Priest.